Equal time. Another viewpoint, other considerations. Equal time.
Good afternoon. I'm Carl Etner, your host for Equal Time Radio on Mondays, usually. I'm fully conscious that this is a Wednesday and little special circumstances. I'm sitting in here. My theme is usually energy, food, and the local economy at the end of the age of oil. We're going to be talking about healthcare also today. And you know, I could do a little bit of spiel, because everything's related. I could do a little bit of spiel about how this healthcare discussion is related to energy, food, and the local economy at the end of the age of oil, but I don't think I'll do that. I'll just unapologetically talk about healthcare. Besides, Anthony Polina, the normal Wednesday host for Equal Time, has said that he wants to devote his Wednesdays to healthcare, so it fits in well with that. We do have a great show coming up today. Later on in the show, we're going to be talking about biochar. It's a fancy name for charcoal. And some people claim that it can reduce global warming, it can provide renewable energy, and also improve our soils for fantastically long periods of time. We'll have a chance to see more about biochar here in Vermont this Saturday at Shelburne Farms' annual Harvest Festival and Energy Fair. So today we'll find out what the excitement is about biochar, talking with biochar expert David Yarrow and Vermont biomass energy maven Jock Gill. But first, what is your doctor not telling you about your health? David Newman, an emergency room doctor in New York City and the author of Hippocrates' Shadow, says doctors know less than they let on, and they withhold the truth from patients. How well does your doctor communicate with you? We'd love to hear from you. Later on in the show, after we get the conversation going here, our telephone numbers, as usual, are 244-1777. If you're calling in the Waterbury area, otherwise, call on our nickel. It's 877-291-8255. Well, I first met David Newman in August in Burlington when he came in to speak to the meeting of the Council of State Governments there, and it was a dramatic talk in a number of ways. First of all, I think you'll agree with me after you listen to him that he has a very dramatic take on the effectiveness of a lot of the things that are done in healthcare right now. But it was also one of those cases that you see on TV and movies, seldom in real life, where a doctor, in this case, was up on the stage and all of a sudden somebody in the audience, one of the legislators attending the conference, collapsed over backwards in his seat in the banquet room. And somebody at the table yelled, "Doctor, doctor!" And David Newman ceased his speech and came on down, began attending the legislator. He's from a neighboring state. And before long, paramedics were there and then an ambulance. And he was about to be wheeled out. I believe he walked out under his own power. He'd recovered enough under David Newman's ministrations then to walk out under his own power. And David Newman went back up to the podium and resumed his talk about medicine. Very effective demonstration that he could get this fainting man back on his feet. I talked to that legislator this morning, and he said he's just fine now, not sure exactly what happened, and he wants me to convey my gratitude to David Newman. So, David Newman, welcome to Equal Time, and thanks from that legislator.
Well, thanks for having me, and if I could have, you know, made some sort of a plant in the audience to dramatize the talk, I certainly would have, but I feel like somehow that legislator helped me.
Maybe. Well, in the current public health care debate, there's a lot of talk about the public option or even single-payer health care. Some people opposed to that say that it would put a government bureaucrat between you and your doctor. And others point out that right now we have insurance company bureaucrats between insured people and their doctors. And the insurance company bureaucrats sometimes make sure that people's insurance is canceled when they get really sick, so they can't get the care that they need after they've been paying premiums all those years. But you, David Newman, have a different take. You're opening up a really different part of a healthcare debate, and I'm wondering, is it fair to summarize what you're saying in your book, Hippocrates' Shadow, as your doctor can get between you and the healthcare you need?
I think that's probably not, I mean, that's certainly part of it. That's not a bad way to say it. I would even say that modern medicine, as we know it, gets between you and the best available healthcare. I think that's probably closer to accurate, because while there are certainly things that doctors say and do that can end up throwing up walls and being barriers to really good care occasionally without knowing it, it's almost always an error when they do that, it is almost always something that they don't intend. So I don't want to put it on doctors as if there's some kind of malintent there, because there almost never is. Doctors are almost universally good folks who mean well, who went into the field to really do the right thing and help the world in a lot of different ways. And it's modern medicine, the way it's taught and the way it's practiced, that has become that barrier.
And a lot of the training or the lack of training for the doctors gets in the way of that, it sounds like. Your training in communicating to patients in medical school was how many minutes long?
I'm not even sure it lasted minutes, honestly. the training that is specifically on the topic of actual communication, what kind of conversations occur between, you know, a patient and a doctor, that dialogue is not something that we work on in any important or specific way, at least where I trained and when I trained. Although I think that my medical school was a top-notch one, I think it's very, very common for there not to be that kind of training involved in medical school.
And from what I understand from Hippocrates' Shadow, your book, the communication skills of the doctor, the way that things are communicated, can be almost as important, sometimes more important, than the actual technical interventions that the medical community does.
Yeah, well, that's often true, and it actually turns out there's very good and robust research that lets us know about a lot of this. And it turns out that when there's really good communication between a doctor and a patient, for lots of reasons, some of them having to do with the patient being more recruited into their care and being more interested in their own health and listening and giving back in a dialogue, for lots of reasons, it turns out that health is almost always better when the communication is better. And that sometimes has to do with something as simple as what we might call a meaning response or a real recruiting of health and attitudes towards health that affect your body and make you a healthier person, believe it or not. This is something that's actually well documented. But it's also sometimes just a matter of getting on a wavelength with a patient that helps the patient and the doctor to figure out what the best kind of simple things like diet and lifestyle are going to be for health in the long run for that patient.
Well, your book is called Hippocrates' Shadow. We should probably give you a little bit of time to explain why you chose this title and why you pay so much attention to this old, old doctor, Hippocrates.
Yeah, I talk about Hippocrates because when I started reading about Hippocrates, I found some really fascinating things that even as a person who is ostensibly trained in the discipline that he is the father of, I didn't know about him. And one of them is that he was a very odd physician, at least by today's standards. He used to go to his patients' homes and, when was the last time we saw a house call from a modern, medical doctor? He would go to homes, he would sort of look at things like the patient's facial expressions. He would spend some real time on that. He would talk to the family and see how the patient normally acted in their behaviors. He would sort of do a really extensive physical examination. He would dote on them for hours, sort of doing things like taking their earwax and rubbing it between his fingers and going as far as smelling their blood, even tasting their blood occasionally. He's very odd in many ways that we think of as being sort of out of the norms of typical medicine. And when I talk about Hippocrates to patients, what I typically hear is people who go, wow, that would be kind of interesting to be a patient of Hippocrates. And when I talk about Hippocrates to doctors, they go, wow, what a freak. What a crazy guy. And they think that somebody who spends that much time at the bedside and that much time learning about the human who is behind the word patient is really doing something unusual and probably without yield. So Hippocrates was this interesting guy. He was very into the patient, very into what their background was. And he was an empirical, evidence-based physician. He really was meticulous about his observational skills, and he spent most of his time at a patient's bedside sort of being with them. Hippocrates' Shadow is intended to be a reference to a couple things. One is the fact that we sort of live in that shadow still. Hippocrates crossed the boundaries of what we used to think of the mystical and the scientific, and he brought them together in ways that were new in ancient Greece and they had never seen before. And for that reason, in modern medicine, I think we're still living in that shadow. We haven't figured out how to do that yet. We haven't figured out how to understand things like the placebo effect and the mind-body connection, and we haven't been able to bring them together with a really scientific perspective. So we're living in that shadow. And then the shadow obviously refers a little bit to the just the sort of shady area that we're in right now in modern medicine, where we don't have a lot of black and white answers, but we sometimes pretend we do.
Hmm. Well, you referred to modern patients hearing about Hippocrates as thinking, wow, that'd be neat to have a doctor like that. I assume we don't have any records or polls of Hippocrates' actual patients, but if we can assume that they had a similar attitude, then you've pointed to a divergence of the expectations of what medical care, health care is all about between the patient and the doctor, since modern doctors, as you said, think of Hippocrates as no way to practice medicine.
Yeah, well, there is this tremendous divergence where doctors really, going through medical school these days, what you learn over the last few decades in medical school and what you're good at and what you want, what your expectation is when you see a patient, generally speaking, is you want to find pathology and diagnose disease. And patients have a completely different expectation and goal. They really want to know what's going on with their body. They want to know how to make it better. They want to know how to prevent illness, how to treat illness. And finding pathology and diagnosing disease is something very different than all of those things that I just said.
Hmm. Well, you say in this book that you open up the secrets from the House of Medicine. What is it that our doctors are not telling us?
So, I mean, there's a handful of ways that I mean the word secret, and one of the things I want to be upfront about and clear about is that I think the secrets, you know, it's a sort of a salacious way to say it, and the, you know, the titles for these things get chosen the way they get chosen, partly to try and sell books, and so I a little bit of a mea culpa.
Let's sell this book.
and that secrecy in many ways is, at least in some facets, is very not intentional. It is not that doctors are actually trying to hide things from patients, although in some cases they clearly are, and they would even say that. But in many cases, it is just that physicians know that there is this subculture of medicine and that their aims aren't always aligned with patient aims. And the secrets that I talk about in the book that are the they're the titles for actually each chapter, they're simple things that are sort of unspoken secrets, things like we don't know, meaning physicians frequently don't know as much as I think patients and even many physicians would have us believe that physicians typically know. Modern medicine is only so much evolved at this point. We have a limited amount of information available to us. And we prefer tests, meaning we frequently would rather see a blood test than sit at the bedside and do a physical examination or spend time with a patient. So those kinds of secrets are the ones that I'm talking about, where it's almost something we'd prefer not to talk about rather than something that we're actively trying to conceal.
Hmm. We're talking with Dr. David Newman. He is an emergency room physician down in New York City. He's also the director of clinical research and an assistant professor at Columbia University and St. Luke's Roosevelt Hospital Center. Did I get all that right? How are those connected?
You got them all right.
Okay,
I teach on the Columbia University campus, and I teach a class there about clinical research and about understanding science and research and what it means and interpreting studies and research. And I also do my own clinical research in the Department of Emergency Medicine at St. Luke's and Roosevelt Hospitals, which are affiliated Columbia University hospitals.
And if that's not enough, he's the author of the book we've been talking about, Hippocrates' Shadow. He is a major in the U.S. Army Reserves and has served a tour of duty in Iraq and visited Burlington in August and gave a very well-received talk there. We're going to continue this conversation, and I'd like to bring up one of the things that doctors don't know. This book is just chock full of examples, just stories from the field of medicine, both from the battlefield in Iraq and just camps in Iraq, as well as emergency rooms. And David Newman's background as a paramedic and as a doctor in training and a doctor. One of them is abdominal pain. And a lot of times people go in with abdominal pain, they get a diagnosis, and the diagnosis is almost by definition wrong. We'll hear more about that and your phone calls right after this. Good afternoon. Welcome back to Equal Time here on WDEV. I'm Carl Ettnayer, and we're talking with David Newman. He's an emergency room physician down in New York City. He's the author of Hippocrates' Shadow, What Doctors Don't Know, Don't Tell You, and How Truth Can Repair the Doctor-Patient Breach. David Newman, tell us about abdominal pain, as people report it, how it's diagnosed, and what the medical profession really knows about it.
What I talk about in the book is my own experience working in the emergency department and having my own mother come in with severe abdominal pain, and it was a bit of a discovery moment for me when after a long battery of tests and a whole bunch of time spent trying to figure out exactly what the problem was, including ultrasounds and CAT scans, etc., in what appeared to, at least at the beginning, to be a very emergent problem, like a major emergency. One of my colleagues sort of turned to me and shrugged his shoulders and said, I don't know, got me. And I sort of came to this sort of brief discovery about how it is that we make diagnoses, and while we hand diagnoses to patients and patient families very frequently, this physician turned to me, and there's no baloneying another doctor, particularly another emergency physician, in this scenario. And he had a moment of real true transparency and honesty, and he said, "I don't know, you got me." And it was a moment that I think I realized I hadn't given to enough of my own patients, because it turns out that abdominal pain, when you come into an emergency department, something on the order of about 40% of the time, we don't actually know where it came from. It's a big black box in there in the abdominal cavity, and there's a whole lot of organs, and any one of them can hurt or give you a little bit of dysfunction, particularly temporarily. And in many cases, we don't know why that happened or why it is that an abdomen is hurting. If it goes away and gets better, then we frequently never know. And that's sort of the best case scenario, because it means it wasn't very serious. And yet, it also means when you walk out of an emergency department or a clinic or your primary care office, and you've just been handed a diagnosis like gastritis or potential ulcer disease or something along those lines, it frequently is a little bit of a contrivance, meaning that the physician thinks it might be that, but it turns out a lot of times when we think it might be that, if you do the proper tests looking for that, the patient actually doesn't have that disease. So really, we'd be better off, if we were being totally honest, just saying, "You got me. I don't really know where this belly pain's coming from."
So you talk a fair amount in other sections of the book about unnecessary tests that are done. This is a case of tests that would be necessary to make the diagnosis, but maybe for the patient's health, it's not necessary that it's an accurate diagnosis. Their pain got over and they went away, right?
Yeah, well, there's a whole lot of testing that gets done in any one of these scenarios, and partly it's become one of these expectations of modern medicine. If you have something that seems like it's going wrong, you go to your doctor and you expect a test of some sort. And the presumption, the sort of foundational presumption when somebody walks in and expects a test, or when a physician walks in expecting to test someone, which is just as common as the patient expecting to be tested, the foundational presumption there is that actually talking to the patient and actually touching the patient isn't going to be adequate by itself, when in fact it turns out that it is only a small percentage of patients in whom any kind of a objective scientific test becomes very important in making a diagnosis. It's really, if there's an incremental benefit to all those tests, it's a small one, and it's selected patients. And if we were a little more careful about that selection, we probably wouldn't be doing so many of those tests.
Well, a lot of what your analysis in Hippocrates' Shadow comes down to is these divergent expectations about the interaction between the doctor and the patient. The patient wants one thing, the doctor thinks a patient wants something else. What questions can patients be asking their doctors to guide the doctor to more effective medicine for that patient?
Well, you know, I mean, that's a great question, and there's a whole lot of, there's a handful of answers to that. One thing I'll say by way of what's going to sound like, no humility and pure pitch, is the paperback version of the book is coming out, came out yesterday, and there's actually a patient guide in there that we added for the paperback that is designed to answer exactly that question, and I'm going to answer it for you as best I can, but there's a bunch of little sections there that are designed to help a patient try and navigate some of these issues. And your question is, how can a patient get sort of through all the baloney and get to a transparency point with the physician so that we don't need the extra tests, we don't need the extra pills, et cetera, et cetera. Well, it turns out that most physicians are sort of trained to believe that if there is a problem, there is probably a pill or a procedure that can fix it. That is the way we're trained in modern medicine. And so it's hard to get out of that mold. And one of the ways to get out of that mold is to have a patient who shakes you out of that mold. So one thing that can happen in the interaction is for a patient to come with a very explicit agenda to an encounter with a physician. And when I say explicit agenda, I mean the patient is totally clear about what it is they came for. If you come to a physician because you have a cough and you're feeling a little bit ill, you may have very specific questions, and it turns out that most of the time those questions are things like, how long is this going to last? Is it dangerous? Do I need to do anything about it? What can I expect from this illness, and how can I help to make it go away better? And then, sort of around the sixth or seventh question is frequently something like, and by the way, is this an infection that can benefit from antibiotics? Should I be taking antibiotics? Mm. Well, if you survey physicians before they walk in the exam room for that same patient and ask them what they think the patient wants, it usually is, number one, antibiotics. And the reason that's in their head is because physicians are taught about the things that they can help with, that they can cure with modern scientific devices and vehicles. And so one of the first things in their head is one of the modern devices. And antibiotics are a modern device. And it turns out that the great majority of patients who have those kind of complaints don't need antibiotics, don't benefit from them, are likely to have diarrhea or rashes or an allergic reaction of some sort to the antibiotic, and much more likely, in fact, to have one of those reactions than to be helped by the antibiotic. And patients aren't necessarily angling for antibiotics. They want to know those first five things that I said. How long is it going to last? How do they feel? How could I prevent this in the future? What do I do about it now? Those questions are more important, and redirecting your physician to those questions and helping your physician to understand you didn't come for a pill. You didn't come for a procedure. You came because you were worried about your body, and you want to know how unwell you are, if you're unwell at all, and what to do about it and what to expect from it.
When a patient goes in to see a physician for a specific complaint, then the patient's kind of vulnerable, partially because he or she is sick, and it's hard to concentrate sometimes when you're sick or in pain, and also because there's just that authority in the physician or anyone in a white coat. There's a famous white coat effect that causes some people's blood pressure to rise when they're in the presence of somebody wearing a white coat in a medical facility. Would you recommend that people, if they have these questions, just write them all out and have a pretty specific script to stick to with their physician?
I think that's a great idea, because you can walk in the room and you really can be affected by the white coat. I mean, either metaphorically or literally, you can be affected by that. You can walk in and forget all your questions when the doctor starts directing you in one direction or another, say directing you toward or away from antibiotics as if that was the reason you came and that word hadn't even come up yet, which I find is very common when you look at studies that have done literally video surveillance of these kind of interactions. So I think that's a great idea, to write down everything that you're interested in and explicit agendas. The thing to keep in mind when you walk into the room is that it's your body. It's your health. You are really there because you want to know about you, and you're going to make the final decision about you. You're not going to take a pill just because you're told. You're going to want to know what it's for and how it's going to help and what side effects you have to watch out for. And you're not going to do a procedure just because somebody wanted you to. You're going to look into how that procedure might help you. So keeping in mind that you are really the power in this relationship is something that's very difficult when you walk in and you see that white coat. But that's really the truth. And most doctors, because they really want to help people, they really have great intentions, are easily redirected. Easily.
You have the power. That's something that we've heard a Vermonter say in the recent years, with Howard Dean running for president. And absolutely true in the physician-patient relationship of the patient.
Dr. Dean, I might add.
Dr. Dean, very good. So Dr. David Newman is Director of Clinical Research and Assistant Professor at Columbia University Department of Emergency Medicine. He's the author of Hippocrates' Shadow, What Doctors Don't Know, Don't Tell You, and How Truth Can Repair the Patient-Doctor Breach. It's just out in paperback yesterday, available at locally owned bookstores everywhere, I'm sure. And this, I just have to say, this is one of the most compelling books on medicine and the medical system that I've read in a long time. Something that you can pick up and read just parts of very easily, but it's so compelling that it's easy to read in one sitting from cover to cover. David Newman, thank you for writing such a compelling book and for joining us today on Equal Time.
Well, thanks for your time. I really appreciate your words.
And coming up next, we're going to be talking about biochar. It's a fancy name for charcoal, but it can do a whole lot more than just grill your hamburgers. Some people say it can reduce global warming, it can provide renewable energy, and improve our soils. This Saturday, you'll have a chance to learn more about it at Shelburne Farms' annual Harvest Festival and Energy Fair. But just stay tuned. We'll be talking with biochar expert David Yarrow and Vermont biomass energy maven Jock Gill. We'll get the inside scoop on biochar. Back after this. Welcome back to Equal Time. I'm Carl Etnayer in for Anthony Polina here this Wednesday. Usually I host on Mondays. You can find audio from the shows that I host at equaltimeradio.com. We're going to go to the phones now. We've got a caller, Dave from Plainfield. And Dave, I have to apologize for you. Artie wrote me a note that you were on the line, and I just saw Dave there. I thought it was our next guest, David Yarrow. So hello, Dave. Welcome.
Thank you. I really wanted to talk to the doctor, but if I have a few moments with you, I will express some of my thoughts.
I'm sorry I let him go before we got you on the air, but please express your thoughts.
I only had to listen to him for about 5 minutes, and I started trembling with excitement because so far, I may have lost count, but I think on the talk shows on this radio station, I think the discussions have been... I think maybe 187 shows on healthcare, and now we've had one on health. What an amazing thing that you have the audacity to have a program on health rather than on healthcare. Because I got to tell you something. This subject of healthcare has absolutely nothing to do with health. Absolutely nothing to do with health. What they really, it's a misnomer. What they're really talking about is medical care. The discussions about healthcare are really about medical care. And all too often, as I think Dr. Dave may agree with me, all too often, medical care also has nothing to do with health. And I'll tell you, what he's talking about is so needed. And talking about Hippocrates, one famous quote that I always remember from Hippocrates is, the man, and that means generic person, the man who is not his own physician by the time he is 40 is a fool. That's a direct quote from Hippocrates.
Well, I can't speak for David.
He didn't say the man who is not his own surgeon by the time he's 40. He said the man who is not his own physician by the time he is 40 is a fool.
Good distinction. Well, I can't speak for David Newman. I was hoping to find a quote from Hippocrates' Shadow, his book, to support what you were saying. I couldn't find it in just a moment here, but I think that he would agree with you that in many cases, health is not necessarily supported by medical care. In fact, he details in his book some commonly used and expensive medical procedures and interventions that are shown to have no effect, or they actually harm the patient. And I wish we could have had another hour to talk with him about that as well.
Yeah, well, I guarantee you, Carl, I'll be going out as soon as possible and buying his book.
That was the reaction of the legislators in Burlington who heard him speak as well.
Yeah,
Dave from Plainfield, thanks so much for calling.
Thanks.
And as I said just before the break, we're going to be spending the rest of our time talking about biochar and what it does, what it is. And we're talking the rest of this hour with David Yarrow. David, welcome to Equal Time.
Hello there.
Hi, David.
Thanks for having me on.
You bet. And Jock Gill as well. Jock, hello.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Why don't we begin with just Jock Gill just introducing this event that's coming up on Saturday, and then we can have David Yarrow explain to us more about what biochar is.
Glad to. Harvest Festival is a tradition over at Shelburne Farms in Shelburne, Vermont. And this Saturday will be the Harvest Festival for this year, and there will be a wide range of activities, entertainment, music, plays, exhibitions, opportunities to explore the farm and see what they do with the farm. The farm, of course, is an outstanding educational facility here in Vermont. Green Mountain Power will be there with a large tent about alternative energy, and David and I and several others will be in the courtyard, the farm barn courtyard, not too far off from the center stage, with a display on biochar. We'll also be in the same area as NRG and Pelergy, each showing their offerings in the alternative energy field.
So that's this Saturday at Shelburne Farms from 10 to 4.
It's, yeah, there should be, I looked at the weather just now, it looks like a really nice sunny day and the temperature in the low 60s.
It'll
be gorgeous. Come on out.
Excellent. And I didn't get around to introducing our two guests in detail. Jock Gill, whom we just heard from about Shelburne Farm, he's a founder of Pellet Futures, a bioenergy consultancy. And he's also the co-founder of Biomass Commodities Corporation, the president of the Grass Energy Collaborative. And he's been working since 2005 to create a biofiber energy sector that produces both biofuels and land stewardship tools to promote economic development. He was, during the Clinton administration, director of special projects in the Office of Media Affairs at the White House, and he's based out of Peacham right here in Vermont. And David Yarrow has done more things in his life than we have time to talk about here, but most recently, every time here in the Northeast I hear people talking about biochar, people are talking about David Yarrow and his contributions to our understanding of the field and demonstrating it. So David, why don't you tell us what biochar is and why people are so excited about it right now?
Biochar is a new word that was invented to describe charcoal produced for the specific purpose of putting it in soil. This is a very new idea to most people. Hardly anybody's ever heard of this. But if you do this properly and put charcoal in soil, it accomplishes several very critical things we need to do today. The first thing it does is it sequesters carbon. Carbon that you put in soil, this charcoal, will stay there for hundreds, probably thousands of years, out of the atmosphere, thereby reducing our global warming situation. It also, in the soil, doesn't just sit there. It creates a very extraordinary condition of fertility, which is based on engendering the biological activity in the soil. The charcoal acts like a sponge to soak up and hold water and nutrients, and then it becomes a substrate for living organisms to get established on. And it shifts our whole approach to soil fertility from a chemical to a biological perspective. And then in the process of making the charcoal, we distill out, we cook it and bake it in a steel can, and we remove all the volatile elements, which includes gases and liquids, all of which can be reprocessed into renewable fuels. So just right from the top, this strategy solves three major problems that we're facing today and allows us to go about building a sustainable society, providing food and energy in a renewable way.
Now, biochar is a relatively new concept in this country and for modern science, but it's based on discoveries that go back hundreds of years in the Amazon, right?
Actually, this practice started 6,000 years ago in
6,000?
The western Amazon.
Wow.
It has a lot of scientific data to back it up. This discovery of doing the strategy actually came not out of agricultural or soil science, but out of archaeology, studying sites in the Amazon basin where they found these extraordinarily dark and highly fertile soils. Matter of fact, these soils are still highly fertile and highly productive 300 years after the people that made them disappeared into extinction. And so in the process of examining these soils, this idea of sequestering carbon the way these ancient Amazon tribes were doing has come to the forefront in a very timely way right now.
Now, the tropical soils in the Amazon are well known among agronomists as being very poor in nutrients in general. They're old soils, they're weathered, and to put it simply, that the places where the nutrients can hook onto just have been weathered away. And so adding something like biochar to it can have tremendous improvements. What do we know about its effect in improving soil fertility in more temperate soils like we have here in Vermont?
Not much yet. There's been research about this in Japan, which shares our climate, and they're about 20 years ahead of American understanding and applying this method. But here in America, we haven't paid any attention. We've been too busy spreading chemical fertilizers around. The preliminary indications are, by people that have been doing this on their own, is that it has a very positive impact. For example, there's a farmer out on Cape Cod who features his heirloom turnips at the farmer's market. And he used to grow two-pound turnips. 3 years ago, he started putting charcoal in his soil. He said at a round table we had in May that he now sells eight-pound turnips.
Eight-pound turnips from 2 pounds.
That's
wow.
That's what he said. I haven't seen them, but that's what he said.
Wow. Do you know what kind of soil he has?
Cape Cod soil. I'm
not sure.
It should
be sandy.
We call it soil. It might be more like sand.
Right. And I would guess that sandy soil would benefit more than clay soil from the addition of these small charcoal particles. Is that right?
You know more about soil than most people. Yeah, clay has some ability to hold and absorb nutrients, but sand has very little capacity to hold nutrients. And this is what the charcoal does. It acts like a sponge to soak up and adsorb nutrient ions and hold them in the soil so they can't be leached away.
So people talk about biochar in the context of climate change, and you were mentioning that it has an ability to sequester carbon. What's the significance of biochar in terms of the global carbon numbers? How much can we sequester in soils with biochar?
Well, the data from studies in the Amazon of these terra preta soils produced by the indigenous tribes suggest that up to 9% of soil could be this kind of charred carbon, and these soils are at least 2 and often as much as 6 feet deep. So we're talking about being able to store at least 20 tons per acre of carbon in agricultural soils. And James Hansen last summer evaluated scientific data on this idea, and he came to the conclusion that if we did this worldwide using agricultural and forestry waste, that we could probably turn the corner on climate change. We could begin lowering the level of CO2 in the atmosphere within 50 years.
Lower the level of CO2 within 50 years. And
yeah.
James Hansen, of course, is the NASA climatologist who is one of the most prominent scientists in the climate debate. So if he says it, then there's a lot of authority behind that.
He thinks this can work. He understands that we need to do a lot of other things besides just put charcoal in soil, but he recognizes that this strategy will sequester carbon and can be done at a scale where it will have a significant impact on our global warming situation.
Well, we're going to be talking with Jock Gill from Peacham about the potential for biochar specifically in Vermont. We'll be taking your phone calls at 244-1777 or toll-free 877-291-8255. David Yarrow, and you'll be here at Shelburne Farms on Saturday, correct?
Yes.
Yep.
David, I'm looking forward to it. I've found that people in Vermont are very aware of the earth and our situation and very excited to be offered the opportunity to do something about this condition.
Well, that's the 31st Annual Harvest Festival and Energy Fair at Shelburne Farms this Saturday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Mm-hmm. David Yarrow, thanks for coming to Vermont and sharing this, and thanks for spending time with us on the air.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll be back talking with Jock Gill right after this. Welcome back to Equal Time. I'm Carl Etnayer, your usual Monday host, and we're talking today, Wednesday, now with Jock Gill about biochar and its ability to increase soil fertility, sequester carbon, and make fuels. So, Jock, you're over in Peacham. You've been studying, you've been part of the energy scene for a long time and have thought a lot about the criteria for putting together a sustainable energy system using biomass. How does biochar fit into that picture here in Vermont? Hello, Jock.
Carl,
yes.
I'm here.
Great.
You ask good questions that require some thought.
Okay.
I guess the answer to be, is at the moment, because we don't have the capacity to make biochar in sufficient quantities in Vermont, we haven't developed the answers. So the answer is we need to decide after we investigate the situation whether we're going to pursue this. And if we are, we need to acquire the ability to make sufficient quantities of char to do the kinds of research at UVM and Vermont Technical College, Middlebury, and so on and so forth, that would give people the confidence that this was, in fact, a prudent thing to do.
And is there anything like that that's beginning to happen right now?
Well, in my usual way, I'm out lobbying for this at various legislators and state senators and Senator Leahy, Senator Sanders, Representative Welch, trying to alert them. As David said in his excellent presentation, this whole concept is new to Vermont, where it is ancient history in the Amazon. What David didn't say is that in the Amazon, they covered an area about the size of France with this terra preta.
Terra preta is a Portuguese word for biochar, correct?
Well, it's a Portuguese word for this dark soil.
Mm.
Biochar in and of itself, and we have to be clear about this, when a plant uses the photosynthesis process to extract carbon from the atmosphere, and about half of the mass of the plant is carbon, and we can then use pyrolysis, which is to say a very controlled cooking, low-temperature cooking process, to extract about half this carbon from the plant. And this carbon will be 99%, it'll be about 90% pure carbon. And it has essentially no activity or value whatsoever other than sequestering carbon until we inoculate it with minerals, micronutrients, fungi. It's that, when they take up residence inside this this charcoal reef or this charcoal housing, then when we put that fully inoculated charcoal into the ground, it becomes a good stimulant. In Canada, there's some indication that you can get about 20%, 10 to 20% increase in crop yield. The worse the soil, the better the gain.
10 to 20% increase in crop yield, and that would be with no extra effort in the farming other than adding the biochar, correct?
Basically, you have to be able to obtain it, but what,
right.
When you look at pyrolysis, this controlled cooking process, it has two co-products. One is thermal energy, and one is charcoal. It can also produce oils and a number of other things, but let's just focus on principally on the charcoal and on the thermal energy. So you could take, I'm sitting on my wood pellet stove right now because it's nice and warm and it's kind of chilly out, but you could design a wood pellet stove that, instead of burning the wood down to its mineral basics, could produce thermal energy and charcoal.
You're talking about half-baked wood, basically.
You're talking about half-baked wood that's been baked enough to drive out the volatiles, to generate a lot of heat, and to leave about half the carbon that was in the wood behind as a charcoal product, which can then be used for agricultural purposes.
Mm-hmm.
David talked, I think, very importantly about the quality of the soil, the carbon levels in the soil. A lot of this has been lost, not so much here in Vermont, but in many other places. And if we look at the change in the environment and the effects it's going to have on our fields and our forests, it's important that we become stewards of the soil of the forests and the fields and understand how they work and that they are living organisms, living communities, and that we have... it is in our best interest in terms of the health of the forest and the health of our fields to take very good care of that soil.
Now, David Yarrow talked about reversing global warming by sequestering enough carbon in soils through biochar. Calculations from James Hampson talking about 20 tons per acre of application. He also said that biochar lasts for centuries in its effect on the soil. So does that mean that you do a really heavy one-time application of 20 tons per acre, or would you add it more gradually to the soil over time?
Oh, you definitely add it very gradually over a period of 10 to 20 years. We're not interested in deforestation. We're not in the slightest bit interested in displacing food production. We're interested in taking biomass, agricultural residues, forest residues, waste streams from our culture, which has significant waste streams, and creating recipes for making char that we can then inoculate with the active ingredients, as it were, and then apply to the fields and the forest to get the production benefits as well as the environmental atmospheric carbon reduction benefits.
Jock Gill from Peacham, you'll be talking about this some more at the annual Harvest Festival and Energy Fair at Shelburne Farms this Saturday from 10 to 4. Biochar, look for the big tent with the renewable energy demonstrations. Jock Gill, thanks so much for joining us in Equal Time
Carl,
today.
Carl, can I just pop in one URL for you?
Very quickly.
Your listeners can go to www.biochar-international.org for a gold mine of information.
We'll put that on equaltimeradio.com so you can link to it. Thanks so much, Jock Gill.
Thank you so much, Carl.
I'm Carl Etnayer. That's it for Wednesday's Equal Time. Thanks also to Dave from Plainfield. Love to get your calls here. Don't forget to check our equaltimeradio.com for podcasts of the show along with these web links. Artie Levine produced the show. Thanks for tuning in.